At 10 o'clock, Carlson approached the front door of 28 Goodhart Road. He didn't worry much about the late hour. He had seen downstairs lights on and the flicker of a television, but even without that, Carlson had more important worries than someone's beauty sleep. He was about to reach for the bell when the door opened. Hoyt Parker was there. For a moment they both stood, two boxers meeting at center ring, staring each other down as the referee reiterated meaningless instructions about low blows and not punching on the break. Carlson didn't wait for the bell. "Did your daughter take drugs?" Hoyt Parker took it with little more than a twitch.
"Why do you want to know?"
"May I come in?"
"My wife is sleeping," Hoyt said, slipping outside and closing the door behind him. "You mind if we talk out here?"
"Suit yourself." Hoyt crossed his arms and bounced on his toes a bit. He was a burly guy in blue jeans and a T-shirt that fit less snugly 10 pounds ago. Carlson knew that Hoyt Parker was a veteran cop. Cute traps and subtlety wouldn't work here.
"Are you going to answer my question?" Carlson asked. "Are you going to tell me why you want to know?" Hoyt replied.
Carlson decided to change tactics.
"Why did you take the autopsy pictures from your daughter's file?" "What makes you think I took them?"
There was no outrage, no loud, phony denials.
"I looked at the autopsy report today," Carlson said. "Why?"
"Pardon me?"
"My daughter has been dead for 8 years. Her killer is in jail. Yet you decide to look at her autopsy report today. I'd like to know why."
This was going nowhere and going there fast. Carlson decided to give a little, put down his guard, let him wade in, see what happened.
"Your son-in-law visited the county ME yesterday. He demanded to see his wife's file. I was hoping to find out why." "Did he see the autopsy report?"
"No," Carlson said.
"Do you know why he'd be so eager to see it?"
"No idea."
"But you seemed concerned." "Like you, I find the behavior suspicious."
"More than that," Carlson said.
"You wanted to know if he'd actually gotten his hands on it. Why?"
Hoyt shrugged.
"Are you going to tell me what you did with the autopsy pictures?" "I don't know what you're talking about,"
he replied in a flat voice.
"You were the only person to sign out this report." "And that proves what?"
"Were the photographs there when you viewed the file?"
Hoyt's eyes flickered, but there was little delay. "Yes," he said. "Yes, they were."
Carlson couldn't help but smile. "Good answer." It had been a trap, and Hoyt had avoided it.
"Because if you answered no, I'd have to wonder why you didn't report it then and there, wouldn't I?" "You have a suspicious mind, Agent Carlson."
"Uh-huh. Any thoughts on where those photos might be?"
"Probably misfiled."
"Right, sure. You don't seem very upset over it."
"My daughter's dead. Her case is closed. What's to get upset about?"
This was a waste of time. Or maybe it wasn't. Carlson wasn't getting much information, but Hoyt's demeanor spoke volumes.
"So you still think Kilroy murdered your daughter?"
"Without question."
Carlson held up the autopsy report. "Even after reading this?"
"Yes."
"The fact that so many of the wounds were post-mortem doesn't trouble you?"
"It gives me comfort," he said. "It means my daughter suffered less."
"That's not what I mean. I'm talking in terms of the evidence against Kellerton."
"I don't see anything in that file that contradicts that conclusion."
"It's not consistent with the other murders."
"I disagree," Hoyt said.
"What wasn't consistent was the strength of my daughter."
"I'm not sure I follow."
"I know that Kellerton enjoyed torturing his victims," Hoyt said. "And I know that he usually branded them while they were still alive. But we theorized that Elizabeth had tried to escape, or at the very least fought back. The way we saw it, she forced his hand.
He had to subdue her, and in doing so, he ended up killing her. That explains the knife wounds on her hands. That explains why the branding was post-mortem.
I see. A surprise left hook. Carlson tried to keep on his feet. It was a good answer, a hell of a good answer. It made sense. Even the smallest victims can make plenty of trouble. His explanation made all the apparent inconsistencies wonderfully consistent, but there were still problems.
So how do you explain the tox report?
Irrelevant, Hoyt said. It's like asking a rape victim about her sexual history. It doesn't matter if my daughter was a teetotaler or a crack fiend.
Which was she?
Irrelevant, he repeated.
Nothing's irrelevant in a murder investigation, you know that.
Hoyt took a step closer.
Be careful, he said.
You threatening me?
Not at all. I'm just warning you that you shouldn't be so quick to victimize my daughter a second time.
They stood there. The final bell had sounded. They were now waiting for a decision that would be unsatisfactory no matter how the judges leaned.
If that's all, Hoyt said.
Carlson nodded and took a step back. Parker reached for the doorknob.
Hoyt?
Hoyt turned back around.
So there's no misunderstanding, Carlson said. I don't believe a word you just said. We clear?
Crystal, Hoyt said.
Chapter 37. When Shauna arrived at the apartment, she collapsed onto her favorite spot on the couch. Linda sat next to her and patted her lap. Shauna laid her head down. She closed her eyes as Linda caressed her hair.
Is Mark okay?
Shauna asked.
Yes, Linda said. Do you mind telling me where you were?
Long story.
I'm only sitting here waiting to hear about my brother.
He called me. Shauna said.
What?
He's safe.
Thank God.
And he didn't kill Rebecca.
I know that.
Shauna turned her head to look up. Linda was blinking her eyes.
He's gonna be okay, Shauna said.
Linda nodded, turned away.
What is it?
I took those pictures, Linda said.
Shauna sat up.
Elizabeth came to my office. She was hurt pretty badly. I wanted her to go to a hospital. She said no, she just wanted to make a record of it.
It wasn't a car accident?
Linda shook her head.
Who hurt her?
She made me promise not to tell.
8 years ago, Shauna said. Tell me.
It's not that simple.
Like hell it's not. Shauna hesitated.
Why would she go to you anyway? And how can you think of protecting...
Her voice faded away. She looked at Linda hard. Linda didn't flinch, but Shauna thought about what Carlson had told her downstairs.
Brandon Scope,
Shauna said softly. Linda didn't reply.
He's the one who beat her up. Oh, Christ, no wonder she came to you. She wanted to keep it a secret. Me or Rebecca, we would have made her go to the police, but not you.
She made me promise, Linda said.
And you just accepted that?
What was I supposed to do?
Drag her ass down to the police station.
Well, we can't all be as brave and strong as you, Shauna.
Don't give me that crap.
She didn't want to go, Linda insisted. She said that she needed more time, that she didn't have enough proof yet.
Proof of what?
That he assaulted her, I guess. I don't know. She wouldn't listen to me. I couldn't just force her.
Oh, right. And that was likely.
What the hell does that mean?
You were involved in a charity financed by his family with his face at the helm, Shauna said. What would happen if it got out that he beat up a woman?
Elizabeth made me promise.
And you were only too happy to keep your mouth shut, right? You wanted to protect your damn charity.
That's not fair.
You put it over her well-being.
Do you know how much good we do?
Linda shouted.
Do you know how many people we help?
On the blood of Elizabeth Beck, Shauna said.
Linda slapped her across the face. The slap stung. They stared at each other, breathing hard.
I wanted to tell, Linda said. She wouldn't let me. Maybe I was weak, I don't know. But don't you dare say something like that.
And when Elizabeth was kidnapped at the lake, what did you think for crying out loud?
I thought it might be connected. I went to Elizabeth's father. I told him what I knew.
What did he say?
He thanked me and said he knew about it. He also told me not to say anything because the situation was delicate. And then when it became clear that Kilroy was the murderer,
you decided to keep silent.
Brandon Scope was dead. What good would dragging his name through the mud do?
The phone rang. Linda reached for it. She said hello, paused, and then she handed the phone to Shauna.
For you.
Shauna didn't look at her as she took the receiver.
Hello?
Meet me down at my office, Hester Krimstein told her.
Why the hell should I?
I'm not big on apologies, Shauna, so let's just agree that I'm a big fat idiot and move on. Grab a taxi and come down here. We've got an innocent man to rescue.
Assistant District Attorney Lance Fine stormed into Krimstein's conference room looking like a sleep-deprived weasel on too many amphetamines. The two homicide detectives, Damani and Krinsky, followed in his wake. All three had faces taut as piano wire.
Hester and Shauna stood on the other side of the table.
"Gentlemen," Hester said with a sweep of her hand, "please have a seat."
Fine eyed her, then shot a look of pure disgust at Shauna.
"I'm not here for you to jerk me around."
"No, I'm sure you do enough of that in the privacy of your own home," Hester said. "Sit."
"If you know where he is..."
"Sit, Lance, you're giving me a headache."
Everyone sat. Damani put his snakeskin boots up on the table. Hester took both hands and knocked them off, never letting her smile falter.
"We are here, gentlemen, with one aim, saving your careers. So let's get to it, shall we?"
"I want to know..."
"Shh, Lance, I'm talking here. Your job is to listen and maybe nod and say things like, 'Yes, ma'am,' and 'Thank you, ma'am.' Otherwise, well, you're toast."
Lance Fine gave her the eye.
"You're the one helping a fugitive escape justice, Hester."
"You're sexy when you talk tough, Lance."
"Actually, you're not. Listen up, okay, because I don't want to have to repeat myself.
I'm going to do you a favor, Lance. I'm not going to let you look like a total idiot on this.
An idiot, okay, nothing to be done about that.
But maybe if you listen carefully, not a total idiot. You with me?"
"Good.
First off, I understand that you have a definitive time of death on Rebecca Shays now. Midnight, give or take a half hour. Are we pretty clear on that?"
"So?" Hester looked at Shauna.
"You want to tell him?"
"No, that's okay."
"But you're the one who did all the hard work."
Fine said, "Cut the crap, Krimstein."
The door behind them opened. Hester's secretary brought the sheets of paper over to her boss along with a small cassette tape.
"Thank you, Cheryl."
"No problem."
"You can have them myself, but this one..." "Shauna, you have that photograph?"
"Right here."
Shauna held up a large photograph of Chloe for all to see.
"She's a bearded collie."
"Isn't she cute, Lance?"
Lance Fine stood. Krinsky stood, too. Damani didn't budge.
"I've had enough."
"You leave now," Hester said, "and this dog will piss all over your career like it's a fire hydrant."
"What the hell are you talking?"
She handed two of the sheets to Fine.
"That dog proves Beck didn't do it. He was at Kinko's last night. He entered with the dog. Caused quite a ruckus, I understand. Here are four statements from independent witnesses positively IDing Beck. He rented some computer time while there, more precisely from 4 past midnight to 12:23 a.m., according to their billing records. She grinned. Here, fellas. Copies for all of you.
You expect me to take these at face value?
Not at all. Please, by all means, follow up.
Hester tossed a copy at Krinsky and another at DeMonte. Krinsky gathered it up and asked if he could use a phone.
Sure, Krimstein said. But if you're going to make any toll calls, kindly charge it to the department. She gave him a sickly sweet smile. Thanks so much.
Fine read the sheet, his complexion turning to something in the ash gray family.
Thinking about expanding the time of death a bit? Hester asked. Feel free, but guess what? There was bridge construction that night. He's covered.
Fine was actually quaking. He muttered something under his breath that might have rhymed with witch.
Now, Lance. Hester Krimstein made a tisk-tisk noise. You should be thanking me.
What?
Just think of how I could have sandbagged you. There you are, all those cameras, all that delightful media coverage, ready to announce the big arrest of this vicious murderer. You put on your best power tie, make that big speech about keeping the streets safe, about what a team effort the capture of this animal was, though really you should be getting all the credit. The flashbulbs start going off, you smile and call the reporters by their first names, all the while imagining your big oak desk in the governor's mansion, and then bam, I lower the boom. I give the media this airtight alibi. Imagine, Lance. Man, oh man, do you owe me or what?
Fine shot daggers with his eyes.
He still assaulted a police officer.
No, Lance, he didn't. Think spin, my friend.
Fact.
You, Assistant District Attorney Lance Fine, jumped to the wrong conclusion. You hunted down an innocent man with your stormtroopers, and not just an innocent man, but a doctor who chooses to work for lower pay with the poor instead of in the lucrative private sector.
She sat back, smiling.
Oh, this is good. Let me see. So while using dozens of city cops at Lord knows what expense, all with guns drawn and chasing down this innocent man, one officer, young and beefy and gung-ho, traps him in an alleyway and starts pounding on him. Nobody else is in sight, so this young cop takes it upon himself to make this scared man pay. Poor, persecuted Dr. Beck, a widower, I might add, did nothing but lash out in self-defense.
That'll never sell.
Sure it will, Lance. I don't want to sound immodest, but who's better at spin than yours truly? And wait, you haven't heard me wax philosophical on the comparisons between this case and Richard Jewell, or on the overzealousness of the DA's office, or how they were so eager to pin this on Dr. Beck, hero to the downtrodden, that they obviously planted evidence at his residence.
Planted?
Fine was apoplectic.
Are you out of your mind?
Come on, Lance, we both know Dr. David Beck couldn't have done it. We have a proof-positive alibi in the testimony of 4... Ah, hell, we'll dig up more than 4 before this is through. Independent, unbiased witnesses that he didn't do it. So how did all that evidence get there? You, Mr. Fine, and your stormtroopers. Mark Furman will look like Mahatma Gandhi by the time I'm through with you.
Fine's hands tightened into fists. He gulped down a few breaths and made himself lean back.
Okay, he began slowly. Assuming this alibi checks out.
Oh, it will.
Assuming it does.
What do you mean? Well, now, that's an awfully good question. You're in a bind, Lance. You arrest him, you look like an idiot. You call off the arrest, you look like an idiot. I'm not sure I see any way around it.
Hester Krimstein stood, started pacing as though working a closing.
I've looked into this, and I thought about it, and I think I've found a way to minimize the damage. Care to hear it?
Fine glared some more.
I'm listening.
You've done one smart thing in all this. Just one, but maybe it's enough. You've kept your mug away from the media. That's because, I imagine, it would be a tad embarrassing trying to explain how this doctor escaped your dragnet. But that's good. Everything that has been reported can be blamed on anonymous leaks. So here's what you do, Lance. You call a press conference. You tell them that the leaks are false, that Dr. Beck is being sought as a material witness, nothing more than that. You do not suspect him in this crime. In fact, you're certain he didn't commit it. But you learned that he was one of the last people to see the victim alive and wanted to speak with him. That'll never fly. Oh, it'll fly. Maybe not straight and true, but it'll stay aloft. The key will be me, Lance. I owe you one because my boy ran. So I, the enemy of the DA's office, will back you up. I'll tell the media how you cooperated with us, how you made sure that my client's rights were not abused, that Dr. Beck and I wholeheartedly support your investigation and look forward to working with you. Fine, kept still. It's like I said before, Lance. I can spin for you, or I can spin against you. And in return, you drop all these silly assault and resisting charges. No way. Hester motioned him toward the door. See you in the funny pages. Fine's shoulders slumped ever so slightly. His voice, when he spoke, was soft. If we agree, he said, your boy will cooperate? He'll answer all my questions? Please, Lance, don't try to pretend you're in any condition to negotiate. I've laid out the deal. Take it or take your chances with the press. Your choice. The clock is ticking. She bounced her index finger back and forth and made a tick-tock sound. Fine looked at DeMonte. DeMonte chewed his toothpick some more. Crincy got off the phone and nodded at Fine. Fine, in turn, nodded at Hester. So, how do we handle this?
This ends Disc 7. Tell no one. Disc 8.
Chapter 38. I woke up and lifted my head and almost screamed. My muscles were two steps beyond stiff and sore. I ached in parts of my body I didn't know I had. I tried to swing my legs out of bed. Swing was a bad idea, a very bad idea. Slow. That was the ticket this morning. My legs hurt most, reminding me that despite my quasi-marathon of yesterday, I was pathetically out of shape. I tried to roll over. The tender spots where the Asian guy had attacked felt as though I'd ripped sutures. My body longed for a couple of Percodans, but I knew that they would put me on Queer Street, and that's not where I wanted to be right now. I checked my watch, 6 a.m. It was time for me to call Hester back. She picked up the phone on the first ring. It worked, she said. You're free. I felt only mild relief. What are you going to do? She asked. A hell of a question. I'm not sure. Hold on a sec. I heard another voice in the background. Shauna wants to talk to you. There was a fumbling sound as the phone changed hands, and then Shauna said, we need to talk. Shauna, never one for idle pleasantries or subtleties, still sounded uncharacteristically strained and maybe even, hard to imagine, scared. My heart started doing a little giddy-up. What is it? This isn't for the phone, she said. I can be at your place in an hour. I haven't told Linda about, Maybe it's time to, I said. Yeah, okay. Then she added with surprising tenderness, love you, Beck. Love you, too. I half-crouched, half-crawled toward the shower. Furniture helped support my stiff-legged stumble and keep me upright. I stayed under the spray until the hot water ran out. It helped ease the soreness, but not a lot. Tyrese found me a purple velour sweatsuit from the 80s Al Sharpton collection. I almost asked for a big gold medallion.
Where are you going to go? He asked me. To my sister's for now. And then? To work, I guess. Tyree shook his head. What? I asked.
You up against some bad dudes, Doc.
Yeah, I kind of put that together.
Bruce Lee ain't gonna let this slide.
I thought about that. He was right. Even if I wanted to, I couldn't just go home and wait for Elizabeth to make contact again. In the first place, I'd had enough of the passive. General repose simply was not on the Beck agenda anymore. But equally important, the men in that van were not about to forget the matter and let me go merrily on my way.
I watch your back, Doc, Brutus, too, till this is over.
I was about to say something brave like, I can't ask you to do that, or you have your own life to lead. But when you thought about it, they could either do this or deal drugs. Tyrese wanted to help, perhaps even needed to help, and let's face it, I needed him. I could warn him off, remind him of the danger, but he understood these particular perils far better than I did, so in the end, I just accepted with a nod.
Carlson got the call from the National Tracing Center earlier than he expected.
We were able to run it already, Donna said.
How?
Heard of IBIS?
Yeah, a little.
He knew that IBIS stood for Integrated Ballistic Identification System, a new computer program that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms used to store bullet and shell casings, part of the ATF's new ceasefire program.
We don't even need the original bullet anymore, she went on.
They just had to send us the scanned images. We can digitize and match them right on the screen.
And?
You were right, Nick, she said. It's a match.
Carlson disconnected and placed another call. When the man on the other end picked up, he asked, Where's Dr. Beck? Chapter 39 Brutus hooked up with us on the sidewalk. I said good morning. He said nothing. I still hadn't heard the man speak. I slid into the back seat. Tyrese sat next to me and grinned. Last night he had killed a man. True, he had done so in defense of my life, but from his casual demeanor, I wasn't even sure he remembered pulling the trigger. I, more than anyone, should understand what he was going through, but I didn't. I'm not big on moral absolutes. I see the grays. I make the calls. Elizabeth had a clearer view of her moral compass. She would be horrified that a life had been lost. It wouldn't have mattered to her that the man was trying to kidnap, torture, and probably kill me. Or maybe it would. I don't really know anymore. The hard truth is, I didn't know everything about her, and she certainly didn't know everything about me. My medical training insists that I never make that sort of moral call. It's a simple rule of triage. The most seriously injured gets treated first. It doesn't matter who they are or what they've done. You treat the most grievously wounded. That's a nice theory, and I understand the need for such thinking. But if, say, my nephew, Mark, were rushed in with a stab wound and some serial pedophile who stabbed him came in at the same time with a life-threatening bullet in the brain, well, come on. You make the call. And in your heart of hearts, you know that the call is an easy one. You might argue that I'm nesting myself on an awfully slippery slope. I'd agree with you, though I might counter that most of life is lived out there. The problem was there were repercussions when you lived it in the grays, not just theoretical ones that taint your soul, but the brick-and-mortar ones, the unforeseeable destruction that such choices leave behind. I wonder what would have happened if I had told the truth right from the get-go. And it scared the hell out of me.
Kind of quiet, Doc.
Yeah, I said. Brutus dropped me off in front of Linda and Shauna's apartment on Riverside Drive.
We'll be around the corner, Tyrese said. You need anything, you know my number.
Right.
You got the Glock?
Yes. Tyrese put a hand on my shoulder.
Them are you, Doc, he said. Just keep pulling the trigger.
No Grays there. I stepped out of the car. Mothers and nannies ambled by, pushing complicated baby strollers that fold and shift and rock and play songs and lean back and lean forward and hold more than one kid, plus an assortment of diapers, wipes, Gerber snacks, juice boxes for the older sibling, change of clothing, bottles, even car first aid kits. I knew all this from my own practice. Being on Medicaid did not preclude one from affording the high-end Peg Parego strollers. And I found this spectacle of brand normalcy cohabiting in the same realm as my recent ordeal to be something of an elixir. I turned back toward the building. Linda and Shauna were already running toward me. Linda got there first. She wrapped her arms around me. I hugged her back. It felt nice. "You're okay?" Linda said. "I'm fine," I said. My assurances didn't stop Linda from repeating the question several more times in several different ways. Shauna stopped a few feet away. I caught her eye over my sister's shoulder. Shauna wiped tears from her eyes. I smiled at her. We continued the hugs and kisses through the elevator ride. Shauna was less effusive than usual, staying a bit out of the mix. An outsider might claim that this made sense, that Shauna was giving the sister and brother some space during this tender reunion. That outsider wouldn't know Shauna from Cher. Shauna was wonderfully consistent. She was prickly, demanding, funny, big-hearted, and loyal beyond all reason. She never put on masks or pretenses. If your thesaurus had an antonym section, and you looked up the phrase shrinking violet, her lush image would stare back at you. Shauna lived life in your face. She wouldn't take a step back if smacked across the mouth with a lead pipe. Something inside me started to tingle. When we reached the apartment, Linda and Shauna exchanged a glance. Linda's arm slipped off me. "Shauna wants to talk to you alone first," she said. "I'll be in the kitchen. You want a sandwich?" "Thanks," I said. Linda kissed me and gave me one more squeeze, as though making sure I was still there and of substance. She hurried out of the room. I looked over at Shauna. She kept her distance. I put out my hands in a, "well," gesture. "Why did you run?" Shauna asked. "I got another email," I said. "At that Bigfoot account?" "Yeah." "Why did it come in so late?" "She was using code," I said. "It just took me time to figure it out." "What kind of code?" I explained about the Bat Lady and the teenage sex poodles. When I finished, she said, "That's why you were using the computer at Kinko's? You figured it out during your walk with Chloe?" "Yes." "What did the email say exactly?" I couldn't figure out why Shauna was asking all these questions. On top of what I've already said, Shauna was strictly a big-picture person. Details were not her forte. They just muddied and confused. "She wanted me to meet her at Washington Square Park at 5 yesterday," I said. "She warned me that I'd be followed, and then she told me that no matter what, she loved me."
"And that's why you ran?" she asked. "So you wouldn't miss the meeting?"
I nodded.
"Hester said I wouldn't get bail until midnight at the earliest." "Did you get to the park in time?"
"Yes." Shauna took a step closer to me.
"And?"
"She never showed."
"And yet you're still convinced that Elizabeth sent you that email?"
"There's no other explanation," I said. She smiled when I said that. "What?" I asked.
"You remember my friend Wendy Patino?"
"Fellow model," I said. "Flaky as a Greek pastry." Shauna smiled at the description.
"She took me to dinner once with her," she made quote marks with her fingers, "spiritual guru.
She claimed that she could read minds and tell the future and all that.
He was helping her communicate with her dead mother. Wendy's mother had committed suicide when she was 6.
I let her go on, not interrupting with the obvious, "What's the point?" Shauna was taking her time here, but I knew that she'd get to it eventually.
"So we finished dinner." The waiter serves us coffee. Wendy's guru, he had some name like Ome, he's staring at me with these bright, inquisitive eyes, you know the type, and he hands me the bit about how he senses, that's how he says it, senses, that maybe I'm a skeptic and I should speak my mind. You know me. I tell him he's full of shit and I'm tired of him stealing my friend's money. Ome doesn't get angry, of course, which really pisses me off. Anyway, he hands me a little card and he tells me to write anything I want on it. Something significant about my life, a date, a lover's initials, whatever I wanted. I check the card. It looks like a normal white card, but I still ask if I can use one of my own. He tells me to suit myself. I take out a business card and flip it over. He hands me a pen, but again, I decide to use my own in case it's a trick pen or something. What do I know, right? He has no problem with that either. So I write down your name. Just Beck. He takes the card. I'm watching his hand for a switch or whatever, but he just passes the card to Wendy. He tells her to hold it. He grabs my hand. He closes his eyes and starts shaking like he's having a seizure, and I swear I feel something course through me. Then Ome opens his eyes and says, "Who's Beck?" She sat down on the couch. I did likewise. Now, I know people have good sleight of hand and all that, but I was there. I watched him up close, and I almost bought it. Ome had special abilities. Like you said, there was no other explanation. Wendy sat there with this satisfied smile plastered on her face. I couldn't figure it out. "He did research on you," I said. "He knew about our friendship." "No offense, but wouldn't he guess I'd put my own son's name or maybe Linda's? How would he know I'd pick you?" She had a point. "So, you're a believer now?" "Almost, Beck." I said I almost bought it. Old Ome was right. I'm a skeptic. Maybe it all pointed to him being psychic, except I knew he wasn't. Because there are no such things as psychics, just like there are no such things as ghosts. She stopped. "Not exactly subtle, my dear Shauna." "So I did some research," she went on. "The good thing about being a famous model is that you can call anyone and they'll talk to you. So I called this illusionist I'd seen on Broadway a couple of years ago. He heard the story and then he laughed. I said, 'What's so funny?' He asked me a question. 'Did this guru do this after dinner?' I was surprised. What the hell could that have to do with it? But I said, 'Yes, how did you know?' He asked if we had coffee. Again, I said, 'Yes.' 'Did he take his black?' One more time, I said, 'Yes.'" Shauna was smiling now. "Do you know how he did it, Beck?" I shook my head. "No clue." When he passed the card to Wendy, it went over his coffee cup. "Black coffee, Beck. It reflects like a mirror. That's how he saw what I'd written. It was just a dumb parlor trick. Simple, right? Pass the card over your cup of black coffee, and it's like passing it over a mirror. And I almost believed him. You understand what I'm saying here?" "Sure," I said. "You think I'm as gullible as flaky Wendy?" "Yes and no. See, part of Ome's con is the want, Beck. Wendy falls for it because she wants to believe in all that mumbo-jumbo. And I want to believe Elizabeth is alive. More than any dying man in a desert wants to find an oasis," she said. "But that's not really my point either." "Then what is?" "I learned that just because you can't see any other explanation doesn't mean that one doesn't exist. It just means you can't see it." I leaned back and crossed my legs. I watched her. She turned away from my gaze, something she never does. "What's going on here, Shauna?" She wouldn't face me. "You're not making sense," I said. "I think I was pretty damn clear. You know what I mean. This isn't like you. On the phone you said you needed to talk to me, alone. And for what? To tell me that my dead wife is, after all, still dead?" I shook my head.
I don't buy it.
Shauna didn't react.
Tell me,
I said. She turned back.
I'm scared.
She said in a tone that made the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
Of what?
The answer didn't come right away. I could hear Linda rustling around in the kitchen, the tinkling of plates and glasses, the sucking pop when she opened the refrigerator.
That long warning I just gave you, Shauna finally continued, that was as much for me as for you.
I don't understand.
I've seen something.
Her voice died out. She took a deep breath and tried again.
I've seen something that my rational mind can't explain away. Just like in my story about Omi, I know there has to be another explanation, but I can't find it.
Her hands started moving, her fingers fidgeting with buttons, pulling imaginary threads off her suit. Then she said it.
I'm starting to believe you, Beck. I think maybe Elizabeth is still alive.
My heart leapt into my throat. She rose quickly.
I'm going to mix a mimosa. Join me?
I shook my head. She looked surprised.
You sure you don't want...
Tell me what you saw, Shauna.
Her autopsy file.
I almost fell over. It took me a little time to find my voice.
How? Do you know Nick Carlson from the FBI?
He questioned me, I said.
He thinks you're innocent.
Didn't sound that way to me.
He does now. When all that evidence started pointing at you, he thought it was all too neat.
He told you that?
Yeah.
And you believed him?
I know it sounds naive, but yeah, I believed him.
I trusted Shauna's judgment. If she said that Carlson was on the level, he was either a wonderful liar or he'd seen through the frame-up.
I still don't understand you, I said.
What does that have to do with the autopsy?
Carlson came to me. He wanted to know what you were up to. I wouldn't tell him. But he was tracking your movements. He knew that you asked to see Elizabeth's autopsy file. He wondered why. So he called the coroner's office and got the file. He brought it with him to see if I could help him out on that.
He showed it to you? She nodded. My throat was dry. Did you see the autopsy photos?
There weren't any, Beck.
What?
Carlson thinks someone stole them.
Who? She shrugged.
The only other person to sign out the file was Elizabeth's father.
Hoyt. It all circled back to him. I looked at her. Did you see any of the report? Her nod was more tentative this time. And?
It said Elizabeth had a drug problem, Beck.
Not just that there were drugs in her system. He said that the report showed the abuse was long-term.
Impossible, I said.
Maybe, maybe not. That alone wouldn't be enough to convince me. People can hide drug abuse. It's not likely, but neither is her being alive. Maybe the tests were wrong or inconclusive, something.
There are explanations, right? It can somehow be explained away.
I licked my lips.
So, what couldn't be?
I asked.
Her height and weight, Shauna said. Elizabeth was listed as 5'7" and under 100 pounds.
Another sock in the gut. My wife was 5'4" and closer to 115 pounds.
Not even close, I said.
Not even.
She's alive, Shauna.
Maybe, she allowed, and her gaze flicked toward the kitchen.
But there's something more.
Shauna turned and called out Linda's name. Linda stepped into the doorway and stayed there. She looked suddenly small in her apron. She wrung her hands and wiped them on the apron front. I watched my sister, puzzled. "What's going on?" I said. Linda started speaking. She told me about the photographs. How Elizabeth had come to her to take them. How she'd been only too happy to keep her secret about Brandon Scope. She didn't sugarcoat or offer explanations. But then again, maybe she didn't have to. She stood there and poured it all out and waited for the inevitable blow. I listened with my head down. I couldn't face her. But I easily forgave. We all have our blind spots. All of us. I wanted to hug her and tell her that I understood. But I couldn't quite pull it off. When she'd finished, I merely nodded and said, "Thanks for telling me." My words were meant to be a dismissal. Linda understood. Sean and I sat there in silence for almost a full minute. "Beck?" "Elizabeth's father has been lying to me," I said. She nodded. "I've got to talk to him." "He didn't tell you anything before." "True enough," I thought. "Do you think it'll be different this time?" I absent-mindedly patted the Glock in my waistband. "Maybe," I said. Carlson greeted me in the corridor. "Dr. Beck," he said. Across town at the same time, the district attorney's office held a press conference. The reporters were naturally skeptical of Fine's convoluted explanation, vis-a-vis me. And there was a lot of backpedaling and finger-pointing and that sort of thing. But all that seemed to do was confuse the issue. Confusion helps. Confusion leads to lengthy reconstruction and clarification and exposition and several other shuns. The press and their public prefer a simpler narrative. It probably would have been a rougher ride for Mr. Fine, but by coincidence, the DA's office used this very same press conference to release indictments against several high-ranking members of the mayor's administration, along with a hint that the tentacles of corruption, their phrase, may even reach the big man's office. The media, an entity with the collective attention span of a Twinkie-filled 2-year-old, immediately focused on this shiny new toy, kicking the old one under the bed. Carlson stepped toward me. "I'd like to ask you a few questions." "Not now," I said. "Your father owned a gun," he said. His words rooted me to the floor. "What?" "Stephen Beck, your father, purchased a .38. The registration showed that he bought it several months before he died." "What does that have to do with anything?" "I assume you inherited the weapon. Am I correct?" "I'm not talking to you." I pressed the elevator button. "We have it," he said. I turned, stunned. "It was in Sarah Goodhart's safety deposit box, with the pictures." I couldn't believe what I was hearing. "Why didn't you tell me this before?" Carlson gave me a crooked smile. "Oh, right, I was the bad guy back then," I said. Then, making a point of turning away, I added, "I don't see the relevance." "Sure you do." I pressed the elevator button again. "You went to see Peter Flannery," Carlson continued. "You asked him about the murder of Brandon Scope. I'd like to know why." I pressed the call button and held it down. "Did you do something to the elevators?" "Yes. Why did you see Peter Flannery?" My mind made a few quick deductions. An idea, a dangerous thing under the best of circumstances, came to me. Shauna trusted this man. Maybe I could, too. A little, anyway. Enough. "Because you and I have the same suspicions," I said. "What's that?" "We're both wondering if Kilroy murdered my wife." Carlson folded his arms. "And what does Peter Flannery have to do with that?" "You were tracking down my movements, right?" "Yes." "I decided to do the same with Elizabeth's, from 8 years ago. Flannery's initials and the phone number were in her day planner."
I see, Carlson said. And what did you learn from Mr. Flannery?
Nothing, I lied. It was a dead end.
Oh, I don't think so, Carlson said.
What makes you say that?
Are you familiar with how ballistic tests work?
I've seen them on TV.
Put simply, every gun makes a unique imprint on the bullet it fires, scratches, grooves, unique to that weapon, like fingerprints.
That much I know.
After your visit to Flannery's office, I had our people run a specific ballistic match on the .38 we found in Sarah Goodhart's safety deposit box. Know what I found?
I shook my head, but I knew.
Carlson took his time before he said, "Your father's gun, the one you inherited, killed Brandon Scope." A door opened and a mother and her teenage son stepped into the hall. The teen was in mid-whine, his shoulders slumped in adolescent defiance. His mother's lips were pursed, her head held high in the don't-want-to-hear-it position. They came toward the elevator. Carlson said something into a walkie-talkie. We both stepped away from the elevator bank, our eyes locked in a silent challenge.
Agent Carlson, do you think I'm a killer?
Truth, he said. I'm not sure anymore. I found his response curious.
You're aware, of course, that I'm not obligated to speak to you. In fact, I can call Hester Krimstein right now and nix everything you're trying to do here.
He bristled, but he didn't bother denying it. What's your point?
Give me 2 hours.
To what?
2 hours, I repeated.
He thought about it. Under one condition.
What?
Tell me who Lisa Sherman is.
That genuinely puzzled me.
I don't know the name. You and she were supposed to fly out of the country last night.
Elizabeth.
I don't know what you're talking about, I said. The elevator dinged. The door slid open. The pursed lips mom and her slumped adolescent stepped inside. She looked back at us. I signaled for her to hold the door.
2 hours, I said.
Carlson nodded grudgingly. I hopped into the elevator. Chapter 40.
You're late!
The photographer, a tiny man with a fake French accent, shouted at Shauna.
And you look like, comme de ton, like something flushed through the toilet.
Up yours, Frederick. Shauna snapped back, not knowing or caring if that was his name. Where are you from, anyway? Brooklyn? He threw his hands up.
I cannot work like this.
Aretha Feldman, Shauna's agent, hurried over.
Don't worry, Francois. Our makeup man will work magic on her. She always looks like hell when she arrives. We'll be right back.
Aretha grabbed Shauna's elbow hard but never let up the smile. To Shauna, sotto voce, she said,
What the hell is wrong with you?
I don't need this crap.
Don't play prima donna with me. I had a rough night, okay?
Not okay. Get in that makeup chair. The makeup artist gasped in horror when he saw Shauna.
What are those bags under your eyes? He cried. Are we doing a shoot for Samsonite luggage now?
Ha ha. Shauna moved toward the chair.
Oh, Aretha said. This came for you.
She held an envelope in her hand. Shauna squinted.
What is it?
Beats me. A messenger service dropped it off 10 minutes ago. Said it was urgent.
She handed the envelope to Shauna. Shauna took it in one hand and flipped it over. She looked at the familiar scrawl on the front of the envelope, just the word Shauna, and felt her stomach clench. Still staring at the handwriting, Shauna said, Give me a second.
Now's not the time.
A second. The makeup artist and agent stepped away. Shauna slid open the seal. A blank white card with the same familiar handwriting fell out. Shauna picked it up. The note was brief. Go to the ladies' room. Shauna tried to keep her breath even. She stood.
What's wrong?
Aretha said. I have to pee, she said, the calmness in her voice surprising even her. Where's the head?
Down the hall on the left.
I'll be right back. 2 minutes later, Shauna pushed the bathroom door. It didn't budge. She knocked.
It's me,
she said, and waited. A few seconds later, she heard the bolt slide back. More silence. Shauna took a deep breath and pushed again. The door swung open. She stepped onto the tile and stopped cold. There across the room, standing in front of the nearest stall, was a ghost. Shauna choked back a cry. The brunette wig, the weight loss, the wire-frame spectacles, none of it altered the obvious.
Elizabeth.
Lock the door, Shauna.
Shauna obeyed without thought. When she turned around, she took a step toward her old friend. Elizabeth shrunk back.
Please, we don't have much time.
For perhaps the first time in her life, Shauna was at a loss for words.
You have to convince Beck I'm dead, Elizabeth said.
A little late for that. Her gaze swept the room as though looking for an escape route.
I made a mistake coming back. A stupid, stupid mistake. I can't stay. You have to tell him.
We saw the autopsy, Elizabeth, Shauna said. There's no putting this genie back in the bottle. Elizabeth's eyes closed. Shauna said,
What the hell happened? It was a mistake to come here.
Yeah, you said that already. Elizabeth started chewing on her lower lip. Then,
I have to go.
You can't, Shauna said.
What?
You can't run away again.
If I stay, he'll die.
He's already dead, Shauna said.
You don't understand.
Don't have to. If you leave him again, he won't survive. I've been waiting 8 years for him to get over you. That's what's supposed to happen, you know. Wounds heal, life goes on. But not for Beck. She took a step toward Elizabeth. I can't let you run away again. There were tears in all four eyes. I don't care why you left, Shauna said, inching closer. I just care that you're back.
I can't stay,
she said weakly. You have to.
Even if it means his death?
Yeah, Shauna said without hesitation.
Even if. And you know what I'm saying is true. That's why you're here. You know you can't leave again. And you know I won't let you.
Shauna took another step.
I'm so tired of running,
Elizabeth said softly. I know.
I don't know what to do anymore.
Me neither, but running isn't an option this time.
Explain it to him, Elizabeth. Make him understand.
Elizabeth lifted her head.
You know how much I love him?
Yeah, Shauna said. I do.
I can't let him get hurt,
Shauna said. Too late. They stood now a foot apart. Shauna wanted to reach out and hold her, but she stayed still.
Do you have a number to reach him? Elizabeth said.
Yeah, he gave me a cell.
Tell him Dolphin. I'll meet him there tonight.
I don't know what the hell that means. Elizabeth quickly slid past her, peeked out the bathroom door, slithered through it.
He'll understand, she said.
And then she was gone. Chapter 41. As usual, Tyrese and I sat in the back seat. The morning sky was a charcoal ash, the color of tombstone. I directed Brutus where to turn off after we crossed the George Washington Bridge. Behind his sunglasses, Tyrese studied my face. Finally, he asked, "Where are we going?" "My in-laws." Tyrese waited for me to say more. "He's a city cop," I added. "What's his name?" "Hoyt Parker." Brutus smiled. Tyrese did likewise. "You know him?"
"Never worked with a man myself, but yeah, I heard the name."
"What do you mean, worked with a man?" Tyrese waved me off. We hit the town border. I had gone through several surreal experiences over the past 3 days. Chalk, driving through my old neighborhood with two drug dealers in a car with tinted windows, as another. I gave Brutus a few more directions before we pulled up to the memory-laden split level on Goodhart. I stepped out. Brutus and Tyrese sped off. I made it to the door and listened to the long chime. The clouds grew darker. A lightning bolt ripped the sky at the seam. I pressed the chime again. Pain traveled down my arm. I still ached all over hell from yesterday's combination of torture and overexertion. For a moment, I let myself wonder what would have happened if Tyrese and Brutus hadn't showed up. Then I shoved that thought away hard. Finally, I heard Hoyt say,
"Who is it?"
"Beck," I said.
"It's open."
I reached for the knob. My hand stopped an inch before touching the brass. Weird. I had visited here countless times in my life, but I never remembered Hoyt asking who it was at the door. He was one of the guys who preferred direct confrontation, no hiding in the bushes for Hoyt Parker. He feared nothing. And damn it, he'd prove it every step of the way. You ring his bell, he opens the door and faces you full. I looked behind me. Tyrese and Brutus were gone. No smarts in loitering in front of a cop's house in a white suburb.
"Beck?"
No choice. I thought about the Glock. As I put my left hand on the knob, I put my right hand closer to my hip, just in case. I turned the knob and pushed the door. My head leaned through the crack.
"I'm in the kitchen,"
Hoyt called out. I stepped all the way inside and closed the door behind me. The room smelled of a lemon disinfectant, one of those plug-in-a-socket cover-up brands. I found the odor cloying.
"You want something to eat?"
Hoyt asked. I still couldn't see him.
"No, thanks."
I waded across the semi-shag toward the kitchen. I spotted the old photographs on the mantel, but this time I didn't wince. When my feet reached linoleum, I let my eyes take in the room. Empty. I was about to turn back when I felt the cold metal against my temple. A hand suddenly snaked around my neck and jerked back hard.
"You armed, Beck?"
I didn't move or speak. With the gun still in place, Hoyt dropped the arm from my neck and patted me down. He found the Glock, pulled it out, skidded it across the linoleum.
"Who dropped you off?"
"A couple of friends," I managed to say.
"What sort of friends?"
"What the hell is this, Hoyt?" He backed off. I turned around. The gun was pointed at my chest. The muzzle looked enormous to me, widening like a giant mouth readying to swallow me whole. It was hard to wrest my gaze from that cold, dark tunnel.
"You come here to kill me?"
Hoyt asked. "What? No." I forced myself to look up. Hoyt was unshaven. His eyes were red-tinged. His body was swaying. Drinking a lot. "Where's Mrs. Parker?" I asked.
"She's safe."
An odd reply.
"I sent her away."
"Why?"
"I think you know."
Maybe I did. I was starting to.
Why would I want to hurt you, Hoyt?
He kept the gun pointed at my chest.
Do you always carry a concealed weapon, Beck? I could have thrown you in jail for that.
You've done worse to me, I replied. His face fell. A low groan escaped his lips. Whose body did we cremate, Hoyt?
You don't know shit.
I know that Elizabeth is still alive, I said. His shoulders slumped, but the weapon stayed right in place. I saw his gun hand tense, and for a moment I was sure he was going to shoot. I debated jumping away, but it wasn't as though he couldn't nail me with a second round.
Sit down, he said softly.
Shauna saw the autopsy report. We know it wasn't Elizabeth in that morgue.
Sit down, he repeated, raising the gun a bit.
And I believe that he might have shot me if I didn't obey. He led me back to the living room. I sat on the hideous couch that had witnessed so many memorable moments, but I had the feeling that they would be pretty much Bic flicks next to the bonfire about to engulf this room. Hoyt sat across from me. The weapon was still up and centered at my middle. He never let his hand rest, part of his training, I supposed. Exhaustion bled from him. He looked like a balloon with a slow leak, deflating almost imperceptibly.
What happened? I asked.
He didn't answer my question.
What makes you think she's alive?
I stopped. Could I have been wrong here? Was there any way he didn't know?
No, I decided quickly. He had seen the body at the morgue. He had been the one who identified her. He had to be involved. But then I remembered the email. Tell no one. Had it been a mistake to come here?
Again, no. That message had been sent before all this, in practically another era. I had to make a decision here. I had to push, take some action.
Have you seen her?
He asked me.
No. Where is she?
I don't know, I said. Hoyt suddenly cocked his head. He signaled me to silence with a finger to his lips. He stood and crept toward the window. The shades were all drawn. He peeked through the side. I stood.
Sit down.
Shoot me, Hoyt. He looked at me. She's in trouble, I said.
And you think you can help her?
He made a sneering noise.
I saved both your lives that night. What did you do?
I felt something in my chest contract. I got knocked unconscious, I said.
Right. You...
I was having trouble articulating.
You saved us? Sit down.
If you know where she is...
We wouldn't be having this conversation, he finished.
I took another step toward him, then another. He aimed the gun at me. I didn't stop. I walked until the muzzle pressed against my sternum. You're going to tell me, I said. Are you going to kill me?
You're willing to gamble?
I looked him straight in the eye and really held the stare for perhaps the first time in our long relationship. Something passed between us, though I'm not sure what. Resignation on his part, maybe, I don't know. But I stayed put.
Do you have any idea how much I miss your daughter? Sit down, David.
Not until...
I'll tell you, he said softly. Sit down.
I kept my eyes on his as I backed up to the couch. I lowered myself onto the cushion. He put the gun down on the side table.
You want a drink?
No.
You better have one.
Not now. He shrugged and walked over to one of those chintzy pull-down bars. It was old and loose. The glasses were in disarray, tinkling against one another, and I was more certain than ever that this had not been his first foray into the liquor cabinet today. He took his time pouring the drink. I wanted to hurry him, but I had done enough pushing for the time being. He needed this, I figured. He was gathering his thoughts, sorting through them, checking the angles. I expected as much. He cupped the glass in both hands and sank into the chair.
"I never much liked you," he said. "It was nothing personal. You come from a good family. Your father was a fine man, and your mother, well, she tried, didn't she?"
One hand held the drink while the other ran through his hair.
"But I thought your relationship with my daughter was..."
He looked up, searching the ceiling for the words.
"A hindrance to her growth. Now? Well, now I realize how incredibly lucky you both were."
The room chilled a few degrees. I tried not to move, to quiet my breath, anything so as not to disturb him.
"I'll start with the night at the lake," he said, "when they grabbed her."
"Who grabbed her?"
He stared down into his glass. "Don't interrupt," he said. "Just listen."
I nodded, but he didn't see. He was still staring down at his drink, literally looking for answers in the bottom of a glass.
"You know who grabbed her," he said. "Or you should by now. The two men they found buried up there."
His gaze suddenly swept the room. He snatched up his weapon and stood checking the window again. I wanted to ask what he expected to see out there, but I didn't want to throw off his rhythm.
"My brother and I got to the lake late, almost too late. We set up to stop them midway down the dirt road. You know where those two boulders are?"
He glanced toward the window, then back at me. I knew the two boulders. They sat about half a mile down the dirt road from Lake Charmaine, both huge, both round, both almost the exact same size, both perfectly placed on either side of the road. There were all kinds of legends about how they got there.
"We hid behind them, Ken and me. When they came close, I shot out a tire. They stopped to check it. When they got out of the car, I shot them both in the head."
With one more look out the window, Hoyt moved back to his chair. He put down the weapon and stared at his drink some more. I held my tongue and waited.
"Griffin Scope hired those two men," he said. "They were supposed to interrogate Elizabeth and then kill her. Ken and I got wind of the plan and headed up to the lake to stop them."
He put up his hand as if to silence a question, though I hadn't dared open my mouth.
"The hows and whys aren't important. Griffin Scope wanted Elizabeth dead, that's all you need to know. And he wouldn't stop because a couple of his boys got killed. Plenty more where they came from. He's like one of those mythical beasts where you cut off the head and it grows two more."
He looked at me.
"You can't fight that kind of power back."
He took a deep sip. I kept still.
"I want you to go back to that night and put yourself in our position," he continued, moving closer, trying to engage me. "Two men are lying dead on that dirt road. One of the most powerful men in the world sent them to kill you. He has no qualms about taking out the innocent to get to you. What can you do?" "Suppose we decided to go to the police. What did we tell them? A man like Scope doesn't leave any evidence behind. And even if he did, he has more cops and judges in his pocket than I have hairs on my head. We'd be dead. So I ask you, Beck, you're there. You have two men dead on the ground. You know it won't end there. What do you do?"
I took the question as rhetorical.
"So I presented these facts to Elizabeth just like I'm presenting them to you now. I told her that Scope would wipe us out to get to her. If she ran away, if she went into hiding, for example, he'd just torture us until we gave her up. Or he'd go after my wife, or your sister. He'd do whatever it took to make sure Elizabeth was found and killed."
He leaned closer to me.
"Do you see now? Do you see the only answer?"
I nodded because it was all suddenly transparent. You had to make them think she was dead. He smiled, and new goosebumps surfaced all over me.
I had some money saved up. My brother Ken had more. We also had the contacts. Elizabeth went underground. We got her out of the country. She cut her hair, learned to wear disguises, but that was probably overkill. No one was really looking for her. For the past 8 years, she's been bouncing around third-world countries working for the Red Cross or UNICEF or whatever organization she could hook up with.
I waited. There was so much he hadn't yet told me, but I sat still. I let the implication seep in and shake me at the core. Elizabeth. She was alive. She had been alive for the past 8 years. She had been breathing and living and working. It was too much to compute, one of those incomprehensible math problems that make the computer shut down.
You're probably wondering about the body in the morgue.
I allowed myself a nod.
It was pretty simple, really. We get Jane Doe's in all the time. They get stored in pathology until somebody gets bored with them. Then we stick them in a potter's field out on Roosevelt Island. I just waited for the next Caucasian Jane Doe who'd be a near enough match to pop up. It took longer than I expected. The girl was probably a runaway stabbed by her pimp. But of course we'll never know for sure. We also couldn't leave Elizabeth's murder open. You need a fall guy, Beck, for closure. We chose Kilroy. It was common knowledge that Kilroy branded the faces with the letter K, so we did that to the corpse. That only left the problem of identification. We toyed around with the idea of burning her beyond recognition, but that would have meant dental records and all that. So we took a chance. The hair matched. The skin tone and age were about right. We dumped her body in a town with a small coroner's office. We made the anonymous call to the police ourselves. We made sure we arrived at the medical examiner's office at the same time as the body. Then all I had to do was make a tearful ID. That's how the large majority of murder victims are identified. A family member IDs them. So I did. And Ken backed me up. Who would question that? Why on earth would a father and uncle lie?
You took a hell of a risk, I said.
But what choice did we have?
There had to be other ways. He leaned closer. I smelled his breath. The loose folds of skin by his eyes drooped low.
Again, Beck. You're on that dirt road with those two bodies. Hell, you're sitting here right now with the benefit of hindsight. So tell me, what should we have done?
I didn't have an answer.
There were other problems, too, Hoyt added, sitting back a bit. We were never totally sure that Scopes people would buy the whole setup. Luckily for us, the two lowlifes were supposed to leave the country right after the murder. We found plane tickets to Buenos Aires on them. They were both drifters, unreliable types. That all helped. Scopes people bought it, but they kept tabs on us. Not so much because they thought she was still alive, but they worried that maybe she had given one of us some incriminating material.
What incriminating material? He ignored the question.
Your house, your phone, probably your office. They've been bugged for the past 8 years, mine too.
That explained the careful emails. I let my eyes wander around the room.
I swept for them yesterday, he said. The house is clean.
When he was silent for a few moments, I risked a question. Why did Elizabeth choose to come back now?
Because she's foolish, he said.
And for the first time, I heard anger in his voice. I gave him some time. He calmed, the red swells in his face ebbing away.
The two bodies we buried, he said quietly.
What about them?
Elizabeth followed the news on the internet. When she read that they'd been discovered, she figured, same as me, that the Scopes might realize the truth.
That she was still alive?
Yeah.
But if she were overseas, it would still take a hell of a lot to find her.
That's what I told her. But she said that wouldn't stop them. They'd come after me, or her mother, or you. But...
Again he stopped, dropped his head.
I don't know how important all that was.
What do you mean?
Sometimes I think she wanted it to happen.
He fiddled with the drink, jiggled the ice.
She wanted to come back to you, David. I think the bodies were just an excuse.
I waited again. He drank some more. He took another peek out the window.
It's your turn, he said to me.
What?
I want some answers now, he said. Like, how did she contact you? How did you get away from the police, where you think she is?
I hesitated, but not very long. What choice did I really have here?
Elizabeth contacted me by anonymous emails. She spoke in code only I'd understand. What kind of code?
She made references to things in our past. Hoyt nodded.
She knew they might be watching.
Yes. I shifted in my seat.
How much do you know about Griffin Scope's personnel? I asked.
He looked confused.
Personnel?
Does he have a muscular Asian guy working for him? Whatever color was left on Hoyt's face flowed out as though through an open wound. He looked at me in awe, almost as though he wanted to cross himself.
Eric Wu, he said in a hushed tone.
I ran into Mr. Wu yesterday.
Impossible, he said.
Why?
You wouldn't be alive.
I got lucky. I told him the story. He looked near tears.
If Wu found her, if he got to her before he got to you.
He closed his eyes, wishing the image away. He didn't, I said.
How can you be so sure?
Wu wanted to know why I was in the park. If he had her already, why bother with that? He nodded slowly. He finished his drink and poured himself another.
But they know she's alive now, he said. That means they're going to come after us.
Then we'll fight back, I said with far more bravery than I felt.
You didn't hear me before. The mystical beast keeps growing more heads.
But in the end, the hero always defeats the beast. He scoffed at that one, deservedly, I might add. I kept my eyes on him. The grandfather clock ding-donged. I thought about it some more. You have to tell me the rest, I said.
Unimportant.
It's connected with Brandon Scope's murder, isn't it? He shook his head without conviction. I know that Elizabeth gave an alibi to Helio Gonzalez, I said.
It's not important, Beck, trust me.
Been there, done that, got screwed, I said. He took another swig. Elizabeth kept a safety deposit box under the name Sarah Goodhart, I said. That's where they found those pictures.
I know, Hoyt said. We were in a rush that night. I didn't know she'd already given the key to them. We emptied their pockets, but I never checked their shoes. Shouldn't have mattered, though. I had no intention of them ever being found.
She left more in that box than just the photographs, I continued. Hoyt carefully set down his drink. My father's old gun was there, too. .38. You remember it? Hoyt looked away, and his voice was suddenly soft.
Smith and Wesson. I helped him pick it out.
I felt myself start shaking again. Did you know that Brandon Scope was killed with that gun? His eyes shut tight like a child wishing away a bad dream.
Tell me what happened, Hoyt.
You know what happened.
I couldn't stop quaking.
Tell me anyway.
Each word came out like body blows.
Elizabeth shot Brandon Scope.
I shook my head. I knew it wasn't true.
She was working side by side with him, doing that charity work. It was just a question of time before she stumbled across the truth, that Brandon was running all this Penny Annie crap, playing at being a tough street guy. Drugs, prostitution, I don't even know what.
She never told me.
She didn't tell anyone, Beck, but Brandon found out. He beat the hell out of her to warn her off. I didn't know it then, of course. She gave me the same story about a bad fender bender.
She didn't kill him, I insisted.
It was self-defense. When she didn't stop investigating, Brandon broke into your home, and this time he had a knife. He came at her, and she shot him. Total self-defense.
I couldn't stop shaking my head.
She called me, crying. I drove over to your place. When I got there,
he paused, his breath caught.
He was already dead. Elizabeth had that gun. She wanted me to call the police. I talked her out of it. Self-defense or not, Griffin Scope would kill her, and worse. I told her to give me a few hours. She was shaky, but she finally agreed.
You move the body, I said. He nodded.
I knew about Gonzalez. The punk was on his way to a fulfilling life of crime. I've seen the type enough to know. He'd already gotten off on a technicality for one murder. Who better to frame?
It was becoming so clear. But Elizabeth wouldn't let that happen.
I didn't count on that, he said. She heard on the news about the arrest, and that was when she decided to make up that alibi, to save Gonzalez from sarcastic finger quote marks. A grave injustice.
He shook his head.
Worthless. If she'd just let that scumbag take the fall, it would have been all over.
I said, Scope's people found out about her making up that alibi.
Someone inside leaked it to them, yeah. Then they started sending their own people around, and they found out about her investigation. The rest became obvious.
So that night at the lake, I said, it was about revenge. He mulled that over.
In part, yes. And in part, it was about covering up the truth about Brandon Scope. He was a dead hero. Maintaining that legacy meant a lot to his father.
And, I thought, to my sister.
I still don't get why she kept that stuff in a safety deposit box, I said.
Evidence, he said.
Of what?
That she killed Brandon Scope, and that she did it in self-defense. No matter what else happened, Elizabeth didn't want someone else to take the blame for what she did. Naive, wouldn't you say?
No, I wouldn't. I sat there and let the truth try to settle in. Not happening. Not yet, anyway. Maybe this wasn't the full truth. I knew that better than anyone. I looked at my father-in-law, the sagging skin, the thinning hair, the softening gut, the still impressive but eroding frame. Hoyt thought that he knew what had really happened with his daughter, but he had no idea how wrong he was. I heard a thunderclap. Rain pounded the window like tiny fists. "You could have told me," I said. He shook his head, this time putting more into it.
And what would you have done, Beck? Follow her? Run away together? They would have learned the truth and killed us all. They were watching you. They still are. We told no one, not even Elizabeth's mother. And if you need proof we did the right thing, look around you. It's 8 years later. All she did was send you a few anonymous emails, and look what happened.
A car door slammed.
Hoyt pounced toward the window like a big cat. He peered out again.
Same car you arrived in. Two black men inside.
They're here for me.
You sure they don't work for Scope?
Positive. On cue, my new cell phone rang. I picked it up.
Everything okay?
Tyrese asked.
Yeah. Step outside.
Why?
You trust that cop?
I'm not sure.
Step outside.
I told Hoyt that I had to go. He seemed too drained to care. I retrieved the Glock and hurried for the door. Tyrese and Brutus were waiting for me. The rain had let up a bit, but none of us seemed to care.
Got a call for you. Stand over there.
Why?
Personal, Tyrese said. I don't want to hear it.
I trust you.
Just do what I say, man.
I moved out of hearing distance. Behind me, I saw the shade open up. Hoyt peered out. I looked back at Tyrese. He gestured for me to put the phone to my ear. I did. There was silence, and then Tyrese said,
"Line clear, go ahead."
The next voice I heard was Shauna's.
I saw her.
I remained perfectly still.
She said for you to meet her tonight at the Dolphin.
I understood. The line went dead. I walked back to Tyrese and Brutus.
I need to go somewhere on my own, I said, where I can't be followed.
Tyrese glanced at Brutus.
Get in,
Tyrese said.
This ends Disc 8.